I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. I've got a few public hearings today, and so I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 631. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 631, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 631 defines a person for purposes of operating a restaurant or bed and breakfast facility to include a public body, the Oregon Health and Science University, and the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you. Representative Greenleck, I believe you're here to talk to us about Senate Bill 631.
Thank you, and I apologize for my co-chief sponsor, Senator Shields.
He is not able to be here today?
He is not able to be here today. He asked me to carry on for both. You have a different opportunity to beat him up.
We'll just have to get by with you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Mitch Greenleck. I represent House District 33, which is northwest Portland, out into far reaches of Washington County. Senate Bill 633 is an odd bill. It comes to you because there was a norovirus outbreak at the restaurant at the Portland Zoo. And when that norovirus outbreak started being investigated, it turned out that the Portland Zoo is a public body owned by Metro, managed by Metro, didn't have to have regular restaurant inspections. And for a while, they had regular inspections and then decided not to have regular restaurant inspections because they were exempt from the law. This bill brings, by that little odd definition of what a person is, as Mr. Estabrook said, for the purpose of running a restaurant, public bodies that run public restaurants, and adds also OHSU, and for some reason the State Bar, which apparently also runs a public restaurant. It is excluded by that definition. Metro, which is the prime target of the bill, supports the bill in its current form. I don't know whether you hear from it or not, but if not, I'd be glad to share with you a copy of a letter that went to the Senate committee on this. Metro supports the bill, and we found no opposition from anywhere. So all the bill does is bring a group of public restaurants that are currently accidentally, excluded from public scrutiny of the local public health to be included in the restaurant inspection program.
Thank you, Representative Greenleck, and we do have that testimony from Metro in our OLA system.
Good.
Any questions from the committee?
Just a comment. I work in a restaurant when I'm not down here, and it amazes me that they're not under the health department to go through them, because the inspections are quite rigorous. And if you have something that's amiss, they will tell you immediately, and they'll shut you down if there's too many. So I just was appalled that those are not considered, you know, under the auspices of the Department of Health.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dora, it really astounded me. And I think it astounded Metro.
Yeah.
As well, it just wasn't something that had come up until they had a bit of a catastrophe, and then it came to their attention.
Thank you.
And Representative Greenleck, would this require those public bodies that have restaurants to actually have those restaurants licensed with the Oregon Health Authority?
I think the restaurants are currently licensed as restaurants, but they're just exempt from the inspection requirements.
Really? Interesting. Well, that's pretty short, straightforward. Any other questions from the committee? I'm not seeing any. It seems a pretty simple concept. Thank you for bringing it forward and filling in for Senator Shields, who isn't able to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That will close the... is there anybody else that wanted to speak to Senate Bill 631? Didn't see anyone on the sign-up sheet. Not seeing any. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 631. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 23. Bob, give us a brief description of Senate Bill 23, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 23 makes technical and housekeeping amendments to statutes related to the regulation of real estate activities. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And I'm guessing we have someone to talk to us on Senate Bill 23. I've got Lori Skillman by yourself. He's welcome to join you if he wishes, or he may just want to watch you from the background. I'm not sure. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager with the real estate agency, testifying in support of Senate Bill 23. This is the agency's bill, and it does exactly what Mr. Esterbrook said. It's technical and housekeeping amendments to ORS Chapter 696. We did a comprehensive review of the statute and came up with a number of small housekeeping and technical kinds of amendments that we needed to make, primarily for readability, clarity, and plain language. There are just a couple of little highlights on the first page of my testimony. The next several pages are section by section if you care to see what the technical amendments are. But the big ones are defining property management agreement as a contract between an owner and a property manager, one of our licensees, and requires property managers to only engage in the management of rental real estate under such a contract. The others are housekeeping amendments to provide for our new electronic licensing system that will make the system be able to accommodate uploading of continuing education courses taken by our licensees by the continuing education providers. And finally, it's going to require people who register business names to be required to maintain all the information about those names. Pretty straightforward bill. Passed out of the Senate. 30 ayes. So.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Well, I happen to have one for you.
Yes, Chair, hopefully.
Well, I just can't let you come without a question. The property manager, the real estate property manager, is not, I learned recently, is not just the property manager, real estate licensee. It could also be a broker. Is that correct?
Correct. We have three real estate licensees. One is a principal real estate broker. The second is a real estate broker who is required to work under a principal real estate broker until they have the experience to become one. And then the third is a property manager. The property manager's license is limited to the management of rental real estate. A principal real estate broker or a real estate broker may also engage in the management of rental real estate.
So it's not just the principal broker that can have a property management agreement and manage rental property. Also, an individual broker can.
A broker can do that only under the supervision of a principal real estate broker. Any real estate activity they engage in must be conducted under a principal.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 23? With that, I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 23. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189A. Bob, give us a brief description of Senate Bill 189A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 189A allows the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to issue an order disqualifying for up to 7 years a manufactured structure dealer whose license is revoked for certain violations or any other person whose acts or omissions were material to that violation from obtaining a license or working in an administrative or managerial capacity for a manufactured structure dealer. Allows the Director to rescind or not issue an order if the disqualified person pays restitution to a customer the Director finds was harmed by the violation. The measure also declares an emergency and is effective on passage, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have David Tapman and Don Miner signed up to testify. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
I will do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Tapman, the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is a bill that was introduced in the Senate last February, and it addresses what we think is an oversight in the regulation within the manufactured structure dealer laws. A license is issued to somebody to be a manufactured structure dealer. The people that work on their behalf, the salespeople, if you will, are not licensed under the law. And what we had was a couple of situations where we found individuals who we believe engaged in fraudulent conduct, harming consumers significantly. I'll give you one example. There's a company called Fuqua Company out of the Bend area that had a manufacturing plant in Missouri, and it closed down its operations a few years ago, back in 2011, but we found out they were continuing to sign up consumers for purchase agreements. And so, in effect, somebody was making sales and taking money in terms of deposits for the future building of these structures, and yet there was no way they were going to be built. And so, in essence, these people were defrauded of their money. Unfortunately, this resulted in over $500,000 in deposits being taken over the course of 3 years without any recourse on behalf of the consumers when they went out of business. Practices like that are egregious, fraudulent practices like that, we feel would warrant keeping the perpetrators out of the business for a significant period of time. The bill proposes to do that for 7 years, a ban, subject to the Administrative Procedures Act under Oregon law, Chapter ORS 183. That's part of the amendment that Mr. Miner asked us. Just to clarify, we believe that that's always inherent in any action we take, but that is now clarified under the amendment. It also fine-tunes things a little bit. Historically, we could take a licensee. It could be a corporation. It could be a LLC. It could be an individual. We could take a licensee's license away, ban them from the industry for any violation. And we believe that maybe is a little excessive or draconian. So what this does is narrow that down to four instances of fraud or misrepresentation where a buyer or the state itself is subject to receiving misrepresentations by somebody. It also allows us to take that person and ban or bar that person without having to take away the license, which historically we couldn't do. That doesn't make sense to me that if somebody, one individual, is doing harm and wrong, now there may be questions about the supervision of that individual, but that's a separate issue. But we don't think that necessarily you take away the license of the enterprise because of one individual. So again, the law allows us now under the amendment to do just that. Lastly, the law addresses through the amendment a concern we had that where we've seen individuals come into the business, essentially they're banned from engaging in principal activity or significant sales activity, but they can come in and get in through the back door in terms of administrative work. And we've seen this happen because, as you know, we regulate any number of financial services industries where people in all but name are still operating the business, where they put a family member in, a spouse or somebody else. They continue to operate the business, although their title is clerical. We think a ban means a ban. So should we impose a ban, that ban would stand from all aspects of this business. We don't anticipate using this very often. We've had just a couple instances recently, as I mentioned, the one with Fuqua. We had another instance where somebody was charging referral fees unbeknownst to his employer and keeping those referral fees. We think those are bad practices, and again, the victims, if they're not properly compensated, should have, we should protect society from them. One last thing that Mr. Estabrook mentioned, and that is that there is a component that would allow for somebody to make restitution, perhaps not be subject to this ban. That would be an administrative decision to be made. With that, I think you've heard this all before. I will mention that this went through the Senate on a 29-0 vote, and we think this will serve society well and protect consumers without being overly harsh, if you will. We won't be using a meat cleaver for something that needs surgical response. And so with that, I'll conclude here. I can answer questions or wait till Mr. Miner's testified.
Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, to speak in support of the bill. We think it's entirely appropriate to disqualify a person from holding a license if they've engaged in fraud or deceit. And 7 years, that was in lieu of the head of the firstborn child. So that doesn't seem excessive. We did have some due process concerns. The law would allow the division to disqualify not just the licensee, but any other person. And our concern was that any other person wouldn't discover the disqualification until he later applied for a license. So we wanted to make sure that he was part of the original hearing and that he could raise his defenses while everything's still fresh in his mind. And that's done in the bill. As Mr. Tapman pointed out, there's also going to be circumstances, or have been at least one, where the licensee, I think, was the victim of the fraud. And the way the original bill was drafted, it appeared to us, at least, that the agency could only act if they acted against the licensee. And I think this bill now makes clear that they can go after that other person without acting against the licensee. And so we think that's appropriate. And finally, the notion that a person can redeem himself by making restitution, we think is appropriate. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Not seeing any questions. I'm curious, in these cases where you do have fraud and misrepresentation, are those referred to the Attorney General?
Mr. Chair, actually, in the situations we're discussing, we have the authority to both investigate and take administrative sanctions. Oftentimes, we will be in consultation or work in conjunction with the Department of Justice. As you probably are aware, this is something the Department of Justice also has an interest in. They've set down the contract. They've set out the language for the contract for purchases of manufactured structures, and they keep an ongoing interest in this. So we try and meet with them once a month just to share information in areas like this where we think there's a potential overlap.
So in as much as your action is an administrative action, the reason I ask is because of the $500,000 that consumers don't have anymore. Is there ability through your organization to recover that $500,000, or is that action that the Attorney General can pursue?
Mr. Chair, that's a fair point. We do not have restitution authority per se. However, in many instances where we think that the case warrants it, we will enter into an agreement, a settlement agreement, by which the party will make restitution in lieu of us charging a monetary penalty. That's a pretty standard practice within our division. If we were to run into a situation where we think restitution was appropriate, but outside of our ability to do so administratively, we would refer to DOJ. Say there's a third party that was unjustly enriched or something like that that's out beyond the purview of our regulatory oversight. That'd be a place where we would rely on them. To the extent that we can't get the restitution, but we think there's a place to get it. Unfortunately, all too often what happens is somebody's in bankruptcy, restitution's a non-event, and that's the shame of it. We do have some safeguards, as Mr. Miner has identified earlier, such as a surety bond and things of that nature. Now, that doesn't make the person whole, but it helps them go a long ways towards that, because in most instances we're talking about a deposit as opposed to the entire purchase price.
And thank you. And one of the reasons I ask is because I would imagine that a consumer faced with that situation would probably go hire an attorney and, you know, would have to be paying for that. And, you know, does that ever enter into your equation of trying to negotiate a restitution?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We feel like that's part of our mission.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions jumping out of the committee at the moment. We've had a pretty big lunch, so.
Enchiladas.
It's nice. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 189A? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. Bob, give us a brief description of Senate Bill 204.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 204 exempts the Housing and Community Services Department from procedure and notice requirements for disposition of certain real property held by the department and from the requirement to retain mineral and geothermal rights in real property sold by the department. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have D. Carlson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Dee Carlson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice, here to express the department's support for this bill, which we view as cleanup legislation, which does not change the status quo in terms of how we've been interpreting housing community services authority to dispose of property. We do think it avoids future problems, and I'm here to answer any questions if you have any.
Questions? Representative Vega Peterson, I'm glad you were asking because I was going to ask. But
this mineral and geothermal rights in state property, does that happen often? I mean, what's the history behind that?
Well, I think the history is that the state didn't want to give away valuable resources if it was conveying property where it didn't have to. My experience with it is in large parcels of property that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs might have had in their home and farm loan program, where they had farms up in the Mist area or gravel deposits in other areas in central and eastern Oregon. We could, the department could retain those on a normal sale. But for Housing and Community Services Department, they deal in largely single-family homes. They have particular legislative authority in Chapter 456, 625, sub 7 to dispose of property as they see fit to ensure the rights of bondholders and maintain their security. It's never been thought that that statute was trumped by these provisions, but as other state agencies have been exempted from these other provisions, DAS and others have thought that there was the potential for misconstruction, and so we're trying to clarify that by getting out ahead and including them expressly in the exemptions from these other disposal requirements.
And another question?
No, so very low chance of having a gold mine in the backyard of one of these.
Well, I hope not in my backyard.
Yeah. I hope it's in mine.
Yeah, I'll take it.
So the list of ORS provisions that do not apply now under this bill to the real property acquired or sold by Housing and Community Services is... Are those provisions? I haven't actually looked at each one of those. Are those basically the description of those mineral rights and the things that you've alluded to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, specifically, Senate Bill 204 modifies ORS 270-100 and ORS 273-785. to expressly identify OHCS in the our housing in the list of state agencies exempt from the statutory obligations. The first one in Chapter 270 gives certain political subdivisions first right to acquire real property owned by the state when the state agency acting for the state intends to dispose of it. That wouldn't make sense of being consistent with bond indentures in real and single-family loan programs, et cetera, as they're trying to foreclose on properties or otherwise work out situations and sell them to other consumers. Secondly, the other in Chapter 273-785 is the requirement to retain certain mineral or geothermal resource rights or proceeds in real property that the state agency conveys to others. And again, when housing issues bond-financed loans, it makes a commitment that the security for those bonds is going to be available for the repayment of the bond obligations. So the idea that you would bifurcate those rights and try to retain some of them and complicate that process and really complicate the normal process of selling of those real estate assets, the security interest in them, whether it's singly or bundled or otherwise through foreclosure, would be inconsistent with the obligation that's been given to bondholders. It would be inconsistent with purchasers who think that they have the right to sell their home for full value. And as I mentioned before, historically the department has a more specific and language in ORIS 456-625 sub 7 that already gives them the authority to dispose of all of those properties, and I'm quoting now, in such manners the department determines necessary. And historically our office has viewed that that specific language trumped these more general provisions. It's just that as over time other agencies have been specifically added to these other provisions as being exempt, it created the question, well, why isn't housing exempt? And so we're trying to get ahead of that right now before it creates a further problem.
Great. I appreciate the exciting details of all of this, and this certainly cleared it up for me. So, any other questions? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 204? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204 and adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.
What a great.